Right, well, hello everyone, and welcome back to TOSP, the official Cyblogs podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Elf Eldridge.
I'm Amy Woodcroft.
And today, as usual, we've got our eclectic list of various different science stories from the previous week.
We do indeed. Jumping straight in, some of these sort of big news, in fact, over the last few hours really, is the descent of a satellite, the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite, in fact, belonging to NASA, into our atmosphere. Most of it was scheduled to burn up, but there's about a bus-size amount of it that wasn't going to, and it was thought that it was going to split up into sort of, I think, 25, 26 pieces, somewhere like that, and hit the Earth in various places, and there's been a lot of talk about where it might be. It went into sort of a tumbling fall, which makes it very, very difficult to predict where these pieces will come down. And the news over the night, which is when it came down, is that we may never know, says NASA's chief orbital debris scientist. So it looked like it plunged into the Pacific Ocean, somewhere between Hawaii and the western coast of North America. There have been reports from Canada from people saying they saw stuff come down, but it's thought that the reports aren't accurate because it wouldn't have been when they would have been able to see them. So, yeah, currently it looks like it hit the sea. A fun just piece of news. NASA put the odds of a person getting hit by a piece of satellite debris at 1 in 21 trillion. But, yeah, so far it looks like nobody got hurt, and I'm sure there'll be some great jokes coming out of it in the near future.
But don't expect a quick recovery. I've heard the Pacific Ocean is rather large.
Yes, it is indeed.
All right, the next thing is quite specifically New Zealand from me. It's a report published this week entitled, Do People with Doctoral Degrees Get Jobs in New Zealand Post-Study? And simply, no, they don't. Which a lot of people in the kind of educational community could probably have told you. Yep. The actual numbers is that around 65% of the doctoral cohort were employed in New Zealand 4 years after they last studied. So that means that that remaining 35% were not. Which is hardly unsurprising. There were some other mitigating factors. So people with PhDs were more likely to be overseas 4 years after completing their doctorate if they were younger, particularly if they were under 30, if they were Asians, if they were graduates in the natural and physical sciences as opposed to the social sciences. And that actually puts New Zealand's retention rate of its doctoral cohort below that of Canada and the United Kingdom. Hmm. The report puts that down to a lack of opportunities, which is possible, I guess. But just to put some numbers and figures on it, 21% of all those people that they studied, all the postdoctoral graduates, were never employed in New Zealand after the years, in the 4 years after they graduated. Hmm. And of the graduates that were less than 30, only 57% stayed in New Zealand and gained employment, which really kind of puts things into stark contrast because we have really, really good education system here. Mm. We produce some wonderful graduates and then they go and they go overseas.
And they, yeah. And certainly, I mean, a lot of what I hear anecdotally, at least, is that it often comes down to people just really struggling to find work. Yeah, so something to think about, certainly. I believe it's on the radars of a lot of people, but it's always nice to see studies like this that are able to put some really sort of good numbers down.
And there is a lot of us out there trying to kind of fix that problem.
Absolutely.
Don't know how much success we're having, but, you know.
Yeah, takes time. right, the next one is actually all about Aborigines and humanity and stuff, and this is quite interesting. So to put a bit of context in, one of the predominant theories about how human beings spread over the planet is that they did it sort of in one mass migration out of Africa, and they spread then over Europe and Asia and everything like that. And sea levels were lower and stuff like that, so it was often a little bit easier. Now, there is some interesting new evidence, DNA taken from a lock of hair from an Aboriginal man who donated in the early 1920s, so about 100 years ago, has been analyzed using some very interesting new modeling capabilities, genetic modeling capabilities. And it looks like that one migration thing may not, in fact, be true, because this suggests that Aboriginal Australians were the first to separate from other modern humans about 70,000 years ago, which is quite a long time. So you can think about it, well, what it looks like happened was that the Aboriginal population sort of left about 70,000 years ago, with the remaining humans staying around sort of North Africa and the Middle East until 24,000 years ago, which meant that when they started spreading out to colonize Europe and Asia, the Aborigines had already been in Australia for 25,000 years. It's a very, very interesting piece of information. Now, archaeological remains have suggested that they were in Australia from around 50,000 years ago, but this is even longer, and really sort of puts into stark, not contrast, but I guess highlights the amazing rights they have, I guess, to to the land, having been there for so very long.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. I'm totally shaking up our ideas of how humankind colonized the globe, and I guess it really brings into stark contrast how little we actually know.
Absolutely. It does say in the article that it would have been quite easy for them to get to Australia. The sea levels were much lower, and they'd only have had to do one small sea crossing to get from Africa to Australia.
Oh, when you consider the number of huge sea crossings they did after that using just the stars, then that doesn't really surprise me at all.
No.
Okay, other end of the spectrum now, nanotechnology, briefly. An article we picked up on Physics World, but that originally came from Nature Nanotechnology, my favorite journal of all time. The particular article is called Cells Dine on Nanotubes with Dire Results. So carbon nanotubes, this new kind of wonder form of carbon that's been found in all sorts of things from soot to all other bits and pieces that aren't coming to me at the moment, are quite well known to be quite toxic to a lot of cells. And the mechanism behind that isn't really too well known. What a bunch of researchers have just discovered is that when carbon nanotubes stick onto the outside of the cells, they don't just kind of roll around. What they do is they get picked up by the receptors in the membranes of the cells themselves, and then they get turned on the end, so they're sticking up perpendicular to the surface of the cell, and the cell actually sucks them in because it thinks they're a nanoparticle, like a nanosphere, a really small cluster of carbon that the cell would usually take up and then digest and convert into energy. So it starts sucking in this nanotube, and then it realizes it's not small, it's really, really long, and at this point the cell goes and freaks out and sends distress signals to the rest of the immune system, which causes inflammation and cell death and a lot of the dire results that you see when cells are treated with carbon nanotubes. The other interesting thing, so it kind of acts a bit like how we think asbestos affects cells.
Yeah.
So that obviously has really big implications for the whole carbon nanotube industry, because you really don't want this happening. And I guess another lesson is don't eat carbon electronics, which is self-standard. But the other cool thing from this particular report that they found out is that if you cut off the end, because these nanotubes have nice round ends, they kind of look like Buckminster fullerenes cut in half. They just look like soccer balls at a nanoscale. If you cut off the round end and leave it with a abrupt straight edge, the cells don't actually take up the nanotubes.
That makes sense, because they don't confuse it for a sphere of any sort.
Yeah, they're just like, well, that's something weird. Let's leave it outside the cell and not take it
right
up. So there is some really interesting, perhaps we can modify the ends and that will change the cellular uptake and thus how damaging they are.
That's really brilliant news, because, yeah, the carbon nanotube thing is of so much interest, and they're so useful. We can't really, I guess, sensibly sort of say no to the industry. We've got to figure out a way to fix the problem.
Before we move on to the next thing, I should also say that this only applies to the smallest of the small nanotubes.
Yep.
So bigger nanotubes aren't taken up, and they aren't as lethal.
No, cellular pores are pretty small.
Yeah.
They don't admit of a lot. Okay, cool. Talking of things that are pretty cool and molecular and awesome, some of you may have heard about a game called Fold It, which came out in, I think it was about 2009. And basically the idea is to use human brains. It's kind of like distributed computing, like SETI and stuff like that. But instead of using computers that aren't being used, they're using human brains to look at protein folding, because it's very, very complicated. Basically, proteins start out with amino acids strung like pearls on a string, really. And then the order of the amino acids and a whole bunch of other stuff that we don't really understand so far results in the string folding up into a protein with a very specific three-dimensional shape. And that shape is often what decides the function of the protein. So if scientists are looking to come up with novel drugs or anything really, they need to understand the dimensions of proteins. And it doesn't work in, for example, on microscopes, because you look like somebody took a lump of spaghetti and just kind of smushed it flat. You don't get that three-dimensional structure. So with that in mind, there was this awesome game called Fold It that was designed a few years ago. And it throws people at the task of folding proteins. And big news this week was that a whole bunch of gamers who playing Fold It have figured out the structure of a monomeric protease enzyme, which is basically the cutting agent used by retroviruses such as AIDS.
HIV.
HIV. You're absolutely correct. I apologize for that. I should know better. Yes, so they've figured it out, which is really great because it means the scientists can get on with sort of figuring out what to do about this enzyme. You know, looking at it, is it potentially any kind of a treatment thing? What can we find out more? It was published in Science, and this is really cool. The gamers involved in figuring out the structure are actually named as authors right alongside the scientists.
Oh, really? That's fantastic.
That's never happened before. And so the scientists involved are super chuffed because what they're saying, Seth Cooper, in fact, one of Foldit's creators, are saying it's really cool because games provide a framework for bringing together the strengths of both computers and humans. So this paper shows that gaming science and computation can be used to do stuff that, I mean, we have not been able to do before. Scientists had been working with computer models on the structure of this enzyme for years and had not gotten anywhere. And the gamers did in, I think, a few weeks or a few months, really, really quickly. So that's cool. There's also a wiki. If you're interested in Foldit, you can download it. There's a wiki. People post all kinds of strategies and tactics for it. Some people play it very competitively in teams. It's great.
It's great fun as well, actually. I've just got to say, as a kind of Foldit addict, as I was a wee while ago, back when I had free time, Foldit is actually a great deal of fun to play. It's like a three-dimensional version of Tetris.
Yeah.
But there's other examples than just Foldit of using humans' unique ability to see patterns and manipulate things in the three-dimensional space. There's a website called Galaxy Zoo where you identify and catalog galaxies in a similar way, and that's allowing us to generate these huge catalogs of galaxies that we can't get a computer to identify because they're too complex. But if you just look at them, you can see them. So there's all sorts of ways that human beings are interfacing.
Yes, I think we're doing something similar like that with pictures of Mars or the moon as well, getting people to look for novel features and then try and catalog them. And yeah, if you've ever got some free time, a lot of these things are just so much fun to do, and you're contributing to science in about the best way.
And you might end up as an author on a paper.
You might indeed.
It's much easier than studying. Why don't we just do that? All right, next thing's from me. It's from the Chinese space program, which, as many of you will be aware, is kicking up into a much higher gear and trying to catch up with the Russian and the American powers. And it looks well set to do that because next week, somewhere around the 27th to the 30th of September, the Chinese research group is due to launch an unmanned space lab into orbit. And it's going to be the first in a long series of steps that will culminate with, hopefully, with Chinese having a docking station up there orbiting the Earth. And that should be up by about, when was it, 2020 is when they're planning it for. And they're actually looking at trying to send a Chinese man to the moon after 2020. That's the kind of plan. There's a moon landing and a moon rover due for 2012. And China's only the third nation worldwide to have ever participated in a spacewalk outside of a spacecraft after USA and Russia. So it's really encouraging where there are, when we're seeing so many budget cuts across the board for the other space agencies, that China's putting so much time and effort and care into their particular space program. It's really encouraging to see.
Stepping into the breach. It's marvelous. I mean, they're one of the few countries on Earth at the moment who frankly has the resources and the money to do it. And so, yeah, everyone's very chuffed about that. Of course, it will be interesting to see how a Chinese space program might be similar or different to the other space programs that are currently in existence.
The other thing about it is that they're putting really short, concrete timelines on it. For instance, 2012, 2017 is when they want their lunar samples back, and then man to the moon by 2020.
That's quick.
That's 9 years, which is a good chunk. Comparing this to NASA's plans via President Obama, which is to have a human expedition to an asteroid by 2025 and a journey to Mars by the 2030s, which is the equivalent of waving your hands in the air and saying, in the future!
And of course, that's a presidential thing with any new power structures that come in or any new presidents. It's entirely possible that they'll be like, no, we don't want to.
Completely thrown out the window.
Yeah. So great stuff. A couple of, short things, and then a slightly longer one. These are some interesting videos that we've come across, so we will have obviously links posted to them on the blog. The first one is a time-lapse video, just about a minute, taken from the front of the International Space Station as it orbited our planet at night. It started over the Pacific Ocean and then sort of continues going around, goes over North and South America, and then enters daylight near Antarctica. And it's absolutely stunning. It's a minute of magic. So that's very cool. The other one is on IOP or Physics World, which is a really sort of interesting, is a journal and an online website and all kinds of stuff. There are for IOP members, which is pretty cheap to do. There are some videos. Because, well, in fact, they're all about Rutherford. So there's one about Rutherford's legacy to Manchester. There's one on how Rutherford shaped nuclear physics. And because it's the centenary of Rutherford's, you know, large discoveries, people also just talking about it generally and 100 years on and what they think of it and what it sort of means to us, the discovery and Rutherford himself. So those are quite fun. Go and have a look at those.
Yeah, if you just want something to pass the time, get your hands on a $100 note. You can see Rutherford's Nobel Prize and his atomic decay curve on there as well.
That's true, actually. I'd forgotten about that. Cool. Thank you. And then the next one it's also pretty short because it's really confusing, but I always love sort of quantum Schrodinger equation type stuff because it just does fun things to my brain and I like having my brain turned inside out. So this isn't new so much as, the author, George Musso, who sort of writes about this sort of stuff, came across the idea recently in a lecture, and it's what he calls the quantum Cheshire cat. And basically, we're all familiar with the idea of Schrodinger's cat in the box thing, where basically, to paraphrase, normally the cat can be both alive and dead at the same time until you look at it and collapse the waveform, basically. The idea here is that it's an elaboration of that thought experiment. So you've got a cat, and it's either purring or meowing, and it's curled up in one of two boxes. So as in Schrodinger's scenario, you then couple the cat to some quantum system like a radioactive atom, basically a way of making the condition ambiguous. And, well, until you examine all the boxes. But this is where it gets weird. If you reach into box two, you feel the cat. And if you listen to the boxes, you hear purring. But when you listen more closely, you notice that the purring is coming from box one. You've separated the cat from the purr, and they're in two different boxes. Now you ask, how on earth does this make any sense, or what would this be applicable to? And you can basically do it with an electron, at least in the thought experiment. You can have the electron in one box and its spin in the other. And the article goes on to sort of explain how this might be possible mathematically and what's going on, but ends with the author going, yeah, I'm very confused by this as well. It's quite interesting. And next week at least in an upcoming issue of Scientific American, there's going to be some more details on it.
I'm definitely going to keep my eye on that and try and figure out what that means.
I just love the idea of a cat in one box and the purr in the other. So, yeah, have a look and read of it. It's certainly something I'd like to chat with people about. So if you've got any ideas, do get in touch.
Where does it stop? So there's going to be one cat in four boxes.
Oh, dear. Yes.
Maybe.
We're not talking about the Herald article today about the crazy man and his cats, by the way. Anyway.
Right. Next thing from me is slightly easier to understand. It has real-world implications and real-world applications. There's a new gene therapy trial which may very well have prompted a cure for HIV. So last week we mentioned several different vaccines and ways to make cells immune to the HIV virus.
Yes.
But last year, a Berlin man by the name of Timothy Brown actually became the first human being ever, we think, to be cured of HIV. And this actually came about because he had cancer as well as HIV, the poor guy, and he got a bone marrow transplant from a donor. The donor cells actually lacked this important receptor, which it turns out HIV binds to. So he got a whole bunch of cells that were immune to HIV. Then they replaced all his immune cells. He became healthy, and all of his cells then became immune to HIV. So once doctors became aware of this, they got very, very excited because it's a cure, not a vaccine for HIV. Mm. And then they tried to replicate it. So what they've done now is they've treated 15 patients using gene therapy. This is where you get the genes. So in this case, what they've done is they've looked at that particular receptor that makes people not
susceptible.
Susceptible, that's the word I was looking for, that makes people susceptible to the HIV virus. They've got a zinc finger endonuclease, which is just a standard technique for disassembling proteins. They've essentially screwed up that receptor on all these cells, 10 billion cells from each individual patient, and then re-injected them into patients. Mm. And in one of these patients, they have observed the HIV infection plummet even though he stopped taking all of his antiviral drugs.
Wow.
And I've never, ever seen this result before on anyone that stopped taking the antiretroviral drugs. And that's a really interesting result, but it's only one. This is a very, very small study, and I can't emphasize that enough, but it is an encouraging result. Just like Timothy Brown's result was an encouraging result.
Exactly. I mean, this is the great thing, and even with the stuff like Folded, is you take the problem, and this is science, you attack it on as many different fronts as you possibly can, and one is patient and does the science properly, and answers will present themselves. Sometimes it just takes a while.
Yeah.
But lovely to see that happening, because, man, HIV, it's not cool. We're very happy to see it go away.
And also, the other 14 participants of the study, the problem with testing that is that they're still on their antiretrovirals. Because, of course, you don't want to take them off their antiretrovirals.
No.
Because if the therapy hasn't worked, then they'll cark it. So it's a very, very hard hypothesis to test.
Absolutely.
But one with huge implications.
Hmm. Super clever. Really, really, really clever indeed. All right, mine's a little bit of a fun one. and this is a new study looking at why intuition may make people more likely to believe in God. So in this study, which was 882 participants with an average age of 33 and 64% female composition, they got them to fill out an online survey about their belief in a higher power, a god of some sort, and then they were given a cognitive test. And the cognitive test was made up of three maths questions, all of which had an obvious but incorrect intuitive answer. So one of the examples given here is, a bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? The intuitive answer is 10 cents. The correct answer is 5 cents, of course. And they found that people who are highly intuitive thinkers, which the way they're defining intuitive is reach a decision fast and intuitively and then sort of stick with it, whereas reflective thinkers are more likely to sort of mull something over more slowly, look at it from all the angles, all of that kind of thing. So people who chose the incorrect answer tended to be more intuitive, and there were some people who got it wrong on all three. In that sense. And they found that, yes, they were far more likely to believe in God or a higher power. Now, they then go on to say, look, we're not necessarily saying which is causative of which. It could be that belief in a God predisposes you towards thinking more intuitively. We're not sure. They're not sure what the results mean at all, and they're likely to be very controversial, whatever they are. They also are at great pains to say that, look, it's not that there's one type of thinking that's better than the other. People need both. Certainly the intuitive thinkers were no less intelligent than the reflective thinkers. It's just a different type of thinking style. I have no pretty answers for you on that, but it's a really, really interesting result. I think it's a really interesting article.
Speaking of intuition and humans' response to data and information, one of the big news items this week was the earthquake scientists who have been put on trial in Italy for their for the predictions or lack of predictions that they made around the large earthquake that killed over 300 people, unfortunately. So if you're not up to date with this, what's happened is that these scientists came out and made a whole bunch of predictions around these low-level shocks that Italy was having, and that got interpreted by a politician, and then that then got relayed to the public, and the politician took what the scientists said essentially and said there's no chance of there being a big quake. Right after he said that, there was a big quake and hundreds of people died. So they're being sued for misrepresenting themselves and misrepresenting their case. And depending on how this particular case turns out, and we won't know the results for months and months and months, it could have really a huge impact on how willing scientists are to discuss their data and the implications of their research, which I think is a really sad thing.
I think it's pretty shocking. If one goes and looks at the details, so the government official who said this is also being sued with the scientists. But my understanding, and Alf, please do correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that basically they said, from the data that we have, we can't say that there will or won't be a big earthquake. They were basically saying, we cannot say. We've got nothing that says there will be a big one. We've got nothing that says there won't. The government official then turned that into, there is no chance of a large earthquake.
Mm.
So you could argue that perhaps he should be in trouble for getting it so egregiously wrong. And this happens all the time in science reporting and people talking about sort of statistical stuff, is they don't really understand what is being said and that the message gets twisted. But one could also argue that the scientists who said this should have said something when they noticed that his message was incorrect. So certainly a very interesting set of issues there that need to be thought through. But I think the general reaction is that people are absolutely appalled that scientists would be dragged up into court for something like this.
Yeah, and I mean, just to put perspective on this particular example, there is no scientific consensus worldwide on a reliable method for predicting earthquakes.
Absolutely.
There never has been, despite what any nutters may say. There is no evidence. You can't predict it through looking at existing tremors. You can't predict it from gas activity. You can't predict it from climate conditions. You can't predict it from anything.
You can't even predict it from the moon.
And, yeah. Indeed. So bringing these scientists to account for saying that we can't predict this in either positively or negatively is really a fundamental misunderstanding of probability, I think.
Yeah.
Which happens, sadly, a lot more than I'd like.
Than we would like to. So everyone is going to be watching that very, very closely. And I imagine if it looks like the scientists are going to get in trouble, there will be howls and things could get seriously interesting.
And Peter Griffin on SciBlogs does give an extremely good account of this from both sides. So
he
take
does.
A look at the SciBlogs post. We'll link to it as per usual.
Absolutely. Another piece of news, and so this week we're segueing into talking about the SciBlogs posts that we found interesting over the week, because some of them do intersect nicely with some of the big news. Now, one of the big pieces of news out this week was, I think it came out on Friday, yes, people talking about the possible discovery that neutrinos may just travel faster than light. What happened is some scientists playing with neutrinos, about 15,000 of them over the last 3 years, have got results which they are finding extremely disturbing, mostly. And it's that their results suggest that these neutrinos are traveling faster than light, which, according to our current models of physics, is not actually possible at all. And so there's a lot of head scratching. And they have come out, and I think it's absolutely wonderful, they've come out and said, look, please help us. Help us verify these. Help us check over all our results. Help us figure out whether this is true or not. Because if it is true, of course, there's going to be some fundamental rewriting of our understanding of physics here. Of course, there are other results. For example, scientists have measured the speed of neutrinos arriving from supernovas, and those were consistent with not being faster than light. So lots and lots and lots of confusion. But it's generated some very funny jokes. It's generated a lot of banter and wittering about it. And I've got to say, neutrinos, they are just so interesting. They're definitely my favorite of the subatomic particles. It's always worth just having a look at them and seeing what they're up to now, because they're really, really difficult to measure, superbly difficult to measure. So it's always interesting when we have some data around them. We'll just have to see how this goes on. So there's a post on SciBlogs about it, just explaining some of the background and sort of what's going on, and also some of the theories about what might be happening. It may be errors. It may be faster than light. It may be hyperspace. God knows. There are links in there to articles. There are CERN held a webcast on Friday about it as well, where the scientists actually spoke and sort of, if nothing else, named all the stuff that they'd gone through to try and check that they haven't made some obvious error, like, I don't know, not carrying the one.
Yeah, when you do that.
Yeah, it sucks. So really, really interesting. You can also read the paper on archive.org, and I'd suggest you do this. This kind of stuff is always fun, and it's physics. We love it.
But we do also have to say that has not been published in a peer-reviewed journal yet.
It's not.
It's published on a preprint archive.
Yeah.
And while, because it's at CERN, you assume it's of the highest standard of scientific quality, it hasn't been through all the rigorous usual scientific checks. So don't get too excited about it until someone like Science or Nature publishes it. And even then, it'll still have to be replicated a number of times by other groups before we can even start considering
precisely
the implications of what that result means. Yeah. But for the meantime, we can still poke fun.
It's so cool. Yeah, and just so wonderful to see that the media's been actually quite good also in reporting the scientists not going, we have fundamentally changed physics, but instead going, there's something really weird here. We need to get this verified. Yeah, it's a beautiful example, actually, of the process working and everyone, I think, being quite responsible about saying we don't know what's going on. We need to check this a lot more before we get excited. Nonetheless, it's quite cool.
At the same time going, we may have broken time.
Well, yes, because that's one of the major things about this, is that it breaks the cause and effect sort of arrow of time physics, which we're used to, and the fact that effects tend to come after causes. So, yeah, great jokes. Go and have a look at the wittering.
The next thing is a birthday celebration from our sci-blogger Bridget Gallagher, who is our resident archaeologist and archaeological expert. And this year, the 19th of September, it's an International Talk Like a Pirate Day, it is also 20 years after the mummified remains of a man, nicknamed Ozzy, was discovered by hikers in the Italian Alps, and he's believed to have lived about 5,000 years ago. What makes him remarkable is the condition that he was discovered in. So you get mummies in all sorts of different conditions.
Yep.
Most of them are in pretty poor conditions because the person is dead. A number of times they've been through some kind of a burial process.
Someone's gnawed on them.
Yeah, and they're pretty dried out. But poor old Ozzy, after he died, he got almost instantaneously frozen. So all of his skin cells, all of his stuff is all still hydrated. So that means that things like DNA and other forensic science techniques are much, much more successful. So we found out all sorts of things about him. Interestingly enough, we think he died from an arrow wound to his left shoulder, even though he also had quite badly damaged joints. It was just an age thing. He was about 45, they think, when he died. He had carbon deposits in his lungs, and they believe that this is because of a consistent use of fire. He has tattoos at the points on his joints where he would have had joint pain and joint problems. His mitochondrial DNA that we mentioned before says he's from European origin. He was found with a whole bunch of tools and clothes, a first aid kit, all sorts of other things.
Wow.
And there's actually an exhibition. He's touring around Europe at the moment with a very, very cool website. So for the details, have a look at Bridget's blog. For the rest of it, there's a number of links out there, but very, very interesting, and that was a really, really cool discovery.
Indeed. And the final one is again, a quick one. Michael Edmonds of Molecular Matters is going through a poetic phase, I guess we could call it. He's having fun writing science poetry. There are a couple of recent ones. The most recent one, which is out, I think, today, is called Time for a New Scientific Revolution. And he also put out one yesterday called Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, which is about alternative medicine. So go and have a look. I've got to say, he's pretty good. and is apparently, from the back chatter amongst the SciVlogs bloggers, really just having quite a lot of fun. So that's cool.
Yeah, excellent poetry. And one last thing from me, our blogger from Open Parachute, Ken Parrott, posted a post this week called Where Have We Been? And it's just a repost of a wonderful, wonderful diagram of where all of humankind's satellites have been since they started leaving Earth orbit with Sputnik in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And of course, they've gone to the moon, they've gone to Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, edge of the solar system, sun, all sorts. Really, really cool graphic which shows how many and where they've been. And quite importantly, where they're going.
Absolutely. I can't remember, what's the name of the satellite that's still beetling out of the solar system busily?
Voyager 1 is pushing it at the moment, and Voyager 2 is coming up.
One of them, I can't remember whether it's Voyager 1 or Voyager 2, let me have a look here quickly, has a Twitter stream, which I follow.
Yeah, it's Voyager 2, I believe.
I think, yes, it is Voyager 2, there you go. So it's really quite cool. Every now and then it sort of sends in a little tweet saying where it is and how many light seconds it is away from Earth and stuff. It's just fantastic. I love the fact that Voyager's Twitter enabled. I'm not sure exactly how they've managed it, but worthwhile following.
He hasn't devolved into lolcat's grammar yet as well. Helio sheath.
That'll be fantastic. All right, on to the events of the week. This is an action-packed week science-wise, particularly from Tuesday through about Friday. So first we've got, this is on Tuesday, Future Proof, Earth, Straw and More in the 21st Century. It's in Auckland. So it's looking at sort of earth and straw bale and these what they call alternative or natural building materials. And they're looking at their history, their properties, current practice, new developments, and the role that these materials could have in providing sort of self-sufficient and energy lean housing stock. So it's a mixture of sort of the natural stuff, the sustainable stuff, and architectural stuff. And I with a personal interest in green and sustainable architecture and having helped build a straw bale house, I've got to say straw's pretty cool. So it would be interesting to see what comes out of this.
Also on Tuesday night, the Carter Observatory in Wellington is continuing their foreign navigation using the Stars Stories series. This week it's European navigation, and Dr. Julie Titsov will be talking about the history of Western navigation. So that's going to be extremely cool. Well, I'll probably kick off about 6 o'clock or so. Have a look at the Carter website for more details.
Definitely. On Wednesday there are two events. The first is What's Shaping the Media in 2011. That's at the Turnbull House. And this is journalists from print, radio, online, and television discussing how and why they report on science, what they and their editors are looking for in a science story, and what you need to know before you pitch a story or when the media calls. If one is interested in science communication, that would definitely be useful to get along to. As well, there's a talk called It's Our Fault by Russ Findison, and it's going to be in Hamilton. So this week it's nice to see a good spread all over the country of stuff. And it's talking about risk and analysis. So the blurb here says, the Christchurch earthquakes have sparked fresh concern about the likelihood of a large quake in Wellington. Russ Findison is from GNS Science, and he's going to discuss this topic as part of a nationwide lecture series. He's going to look at research surrounding Wellington's earthquake risk, the impacts that earthquakes can have on our nation, and the importance of our resilience. So let's hope that he's not misquoted by any government officials.
Fingers crossed, but I won't hold my breath there.
Yeah.
Thursday is also another big day. So on Thursday evening, starting at 5:30 p.m., there's a Science Communicators Association of New Zealand discussion. The panel will include Dr. Jilly Evans and Dr. Bruce Campbell and Vincent Heringer. And where is that going to be? The venue of that is still to be confirmed. It's going to be up in Auckland, and it's going to be a discussion with a whole bunch of really, really good science communicators. So if you're up in Auckland, make an effort and go along for that.
Yeah.
Down here in Wellington on Thursday night, out at Holy Bagels in Lower Hutt, Cafe Scientifique is featuring a fantastic speaker. And I have to say that because this week, my PhD supervisor is actually presenting. He's presenting on the physics of rugby as part and parcel of the aforementioned large sporting event that's going on at the moment. Jeff is a wonderful physicist, and he's also an avid rugby fan, so he's going to make it short and engaging. If you're free on Thursday night, head out to Holy Bagels in Lower Hutt.
The only thing I think of when I think about the physics of rugby is the terror of having about a ton or more of pure muscle running at one at top speed. I can feel my bones cracking. But yes. So I think that wraps it up for us for this week. As always, check out the blog, scblogs.co.nz/TOSP, T-O-S-P, where all of the links that we've mentioned will be up. You may even be able to pull it into sort of podcatchers and things like that. We are working on the ability to do that. A thank you to the Science Media Center, as always, for the use of their gear, and to Vic for the use of their space.
And to Rian Sheehan for letting us use his music as the wonderful intro and outro themes. Also, take a look at our other interesting things.
Indeed. Oh, yes, we did. The other interesting things, Pearl, awesome, and there will be links. And yeah, there's so much. This week was really, really cool. So yeah, we'll sign off. Please do get in contact with us if you'd like to talk with us at all. And otherwise, enjoy your week.
See you next time.